This is Leo for KTWH, Two Harbors Community Radio. Got in the studio this afternoon, Tuesday, a couple of days after our great big snowstorm event of the year, a very disheartening event for those of us who worked for 3 or 4 months planning our Cabin Fever event, but it will be back. It will be back. It's a fever reliever, the Cabin Fever reliever. We should have something to announce soon on that, but in the studio with me is Michaela Rice from Gooseberry Falls State Park. It's Wandering Nature News. Michaela, lots of news out there. Where do you begin? We had daylight savings time, and you and I got the memo, but the animals in the woods and the plants, they don't know from daylight savings, right? They just know what the day length is.
Right. So one thing that unfortunately the critters have to do with, Leo, is when we change our clock, all of a sudden traffic is at a different time and people start commuting at a randomly different hour than they were the week before. And so typically vehicle collisions for wildlife goes up a lot during daylight savings switch time because, yeah, the critters don't get the memo that people are going to be driving at different times and all of a sudden they're driving earlier or later in the daytime. So, you know, this morning I was driving again when the sun was rising. So those critters, yeah, were experiencing more traffic earlier this week.
I guess I'll point out an interesting thing is that we have some spring-like conditions that may or may not be on the way. And what I'm thinking is the more that they're the animals' yearly schedules like movement and mating season might coincide with us commuting in the dark might be problematic.
Yeah, a lot of animals have that crepuscular, that dawn and dusk activity. Yeah. So we're kind of impeding on that a little bit more now.
So we've extended the crepuscular in the morning at least. At night, we're all commuting home in less than twilight now, and that's probably welcome for some critters, but you're saying there's a higher risk for others. My only point, really, Michaela, is we've been driving in kind of dark conditions, those of us who are commuting early, for many a month, but what you're saying is we were gradually getting into the light, and then we dove back into commuting into the dark, and until we make up that hour with more daylight,
this is a
period of risk.
Yep, absolutely. Yep, because though we're driving during that high activity time for those critters, so okay. I was kind of anticipating seeing a lot more roadkill this morning. Luckily, I did not. I was ready to take advantage of that, as you know that I have been doing some collecting. But no, I think the great challenge right now is critters are just running out of food with this historical high, you know, amount of snow that we've been getting. I did notice that some buds are coming out on some alder and a little bit on some dogwood. So I'm hoping that some of that is providing food for critters. But I saw a story about a deer in Cambridge. A local landowner just had noticed a young deer curl up kind of in the middle of a field and passed away. So we know that winter severity affects how the animals are getting through the winter, but we're so close and food is on the way and just under the snow, but we have to wait till all that snow melts.
Yes, and the snowpack is quite deep, and as it softens with this intense sunlight, a day like today when it goes from -5 overnight to around 40 degrees in the height of the day and the sun angle is melting snow and compacting it, it's going to be some heavy going, right? And then the worst case scenario would be an ice storm or another big snowstorm on top of this, right? That could be the straw that kind of breaks.
Yeah, for a lot of animals. Yeah. They can't then get into that snowpack. Like owls won't be able to break through that to get to the critters that live in the snow. Walking is going to be really, really difficult. Some critters might get stuck under that snowpack if it's really iced over.
Yeah.
So there's lots of
One thing I experienced working in a sugar bush for several years is there are days when no matter what snowshoe you're wearing, unless you're wearing one that's so big that you can hardly move, you're breaking through and sinking up to 1.5 feet every snowshoe step. That's one thing for you. That's the voluntary activity. But imagine a mammal that weighs as much as you having to go through that.
Absolutely. Now the deer are like sunk up to their bellies trying to walk through this. So you can imagine how much harder just walking around now is for animals that do post-hole break through the the snow.
Yeah, so we're talking about adversity, but we assigned you homework mm-hmm. the last time. Have you made any progress on learning about the mating, the reproductive timing of the mink family?
Yeah, so the mink, well, I'll broaden it a little bit.
Yeah, okay.
Minks, otters, weasels, and fishers are in a group that we call the mustelids.
Yes.
And they all have a very interesting type of reproductive process. So for humans, you know, females will go through a set reproductive cycle, right? Like on a, you know, we have like a 20-day cycle. For some critters, like cats, that's called estrus. For this group of animals, it's something called delayed implantation. So for fishers, this blew my mind. In April, they will be starting to mate, and they won't have delayed, or their embryo won't stick into their uterus until like a year later. So that embryo stays in a dormant stage for like the whole year.
Is this what's usually called the implantation phase?
Yeah,
it's as if their physiology controls when that happens.
Absolutely. So they'll mate and they'll make an embryo. So at this point, it's just a few collection of cells.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just stays like that. And that embryo does not keep developing into a fetus. So there's no growth. It does not stick to the uterus wall, or so it'll stay dormant for up to 6 to 12 months, depending on the critter. It's a process that has benefited animals where maybe some resources and when they have access to mates is kind of misaligned. So they have to be able to take advantage of when they can mate and then when they have enough resources to actually start growing babies in their uterus. So it's kind of a thing that like the stages are broken up into these pieces.
But there might be a lot of ongoing research, but as far as you know, it's very common that the delay is up to a year. And is it triggered by any environmental signal?
I think when they evolved, it was a signal that would help when the embryo would start to attach. I'm still kind of waiting to hear back from a biologist so I can pick their brain about how this is really evolutionarily beneficial for this group of critters in particular. But delayed implantation is not like a rare type of breeding strategy in animals in general. It's just kind of a more bizarre one. And from the outside, you would never know that that's happening.
Was this particular to fishers among those mustelid
That
group?
Was the longest delayed, that
they,
one
they
that
all
I
had
saw.
Some degree of that?
Yeah, wow. But weasels, all the weasels have a dormant stage that embryo stays in. Yeah, they all have kind of some variation of that. Even the badgers, the martens, they all have some level of delayed implantation.
That could lead to them, if the delays are various lengths, that could lead to a kind of a wide range of times of the year for having young.
Yeah,
and advantageous? I mean,
the pattern that they start to develop, that signal is pretty strict within a group of animals. So even when the embryo starts to develop, that's still all, you know, on a hormonal schedule. I'm not sure what the cue is for the body to say, okay, let's start developing this embryo now. That's what I wanted to ask the biologist, but it's complicated.
I was going to say that I don't know what this group of animals has as a typical gestation, but it just intrigues me because they wouldn't really want to, at certain times of the year, have a very, very young, very small offspring with them.
Right.
Like, in November or December seems very harsh.
Yeah. Gestation is low because they keep the fertilized embryo in a dormant stage instead of having a really, really long gestation period. So it's like they're still protecting that young, but it's in a different developmental stage. I think some of these gestations are only like a month or two for some of these.
That's what I was suspecting.
For some of these young. I think otters in particular, they can breed in March and April, and then they'll have their pups a few months later. Some of these critters can also go through like a, they'll have kind of a chance to have another litter. I don't know. It seems like overall they have a lot of options, which helps, you know, promote their population.
And these mammals aren't having just one offspring at a time anyway, so there are several.
I think
eggs
their litters,
fertilized?
Yeah. I think most of these have more than one offspring
sure.
each.
Wow.
Yeah.
You would think the implantation of all of those that have been eggs that have been fertilized needs to then happen in a short period of time. Otherwise, you'd be giving birth multiple gestations at a time. This is a little bit above my pay grade. I actually am not trained enough to offer. There's a lot of questions.
End of story. Breeding for these critters happens all over the map. Sometimes it happens in late summer or midwinter. You know, I was expecting all of these critters to be mating in the spring, but really otters stuck out to me March and April. One thing too that was kind of interesting was male otters. They have to wait till they get of dominant status, so they may not start reproducing till they're 5 to 7 years old, a male. But a female can have, I think, up to 10 or 15 years.
Okay.
So otters live a little bit longer than some of these other critters. So yeah, maybe we'll come back to some breeding later if we talk about an interesting critter. My other homework that you gave me was to learn a little bit more about why our red pole friends and pine siskins haven't been around. And they don't seem like they were out of food in the tundra, and that's why they haven't been coming down. They typically, both of these birds have some sporadic ranges. They have a wide range across the tundra. And so for red poles specifically, their southern flights into Minnesota are really only sparked when they have scarcity up in the tundra.
That intrigues me because it makes me wonder if conditions were more hospitable up in the tundra, maybe that climate change is bringing more cycles where they won't have to fly as far south or south at all.
That could be a possibility, and it kind of depends probably on the bumper crop of food that's available, like the seeds and stuff.
Right, which may, those plants may have cycles of more productivity as well.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, who knew? Okay, well, we missed them badly. So all you red poles and pine siskins, please come back.
I did see some pine siskins at Gooseberry last week.
Good.
My park manager helped me learn how to identify those compared to the goldfinch because they're kind of similar. So I have seen them officially now, but we haven't seen a lot of them like you've mentioned.
Excellent. There's your homework completed, and, you know, it may be an incomplete because you're still awaiting more information.
I answered your basic question.
You get very high marks for participation in class. And I'm not running any kind of class because between the two of us, it's Michaela who knows her stuff as the naturalist at Gooseberry Falls State Park. Michaela, have you got any goings on that are worthy of our attention, worthy of the attention of listeners?
Yes. So these are all programs that are going to be happening starting on Wednesday the 15th, which will be the day that this airs.
Wednesday the 15th.
I have a bird watching story time at the Two Harbors Public Library. So we'll be doing a little story time. Then we'll be going outside to see if we can see any birds and learning a little bit about how to identify different types of birds. And then we'll be finishing up with a craft in the meeting room.
Did I catch the time, the starting time?
10:30.
My show ends at 9. So you'll be hearing this with an hour or two to get yourself down to the library.
Yeah, in case you're free. And then I have another story time and craft that will be happening next month, April 14th at 10 to 11. And that will be The Call of the Coyote. We'll be talking about one of my favorite animals.
Wow.
And then at the park on Earth Day next month on the Saturday the 22nd, I'll be having a little Earth Day celebration booth from noon to 2 o'clock. You can come learn about geology of the North Shore and how the Great Lakes were created. And I'm going to try to have some different activities for all ages to come test your knowledge, maybe win a little prize. And then at 2 o'clock, Jackie Fallon will be back for another session with her birds.
Yeah.
And so that'll be Earth Day.
Now, remind me, this is Jackie Fallon, who usually has falcons?
Yes.
Fallon
yes.
and Falcon.
Yes.
I just am just so amazed by that. Is the booth an outside or inside?
We'll probably have it right outside the theater. It'll be inside.
Okay.
So you can come into the visitor
center. I was thinking, is it rain or shine? You don't want to go to all that work and then be rained out.
No, and I don't know if I want to sit outside for 2 hours.
Oh, it's so toasty usually on April 22nd. You know, the North Shore, it's guaranteed to be in the 70s or 30s.
Yep, exactly. And then finally, I'm starting up my community creations program again. And for April, we are going to be doing this at the library. So this will be at the Two Harbors Public Library, April 28th from 1 to 3 o'clock. come and do some nature crafts with me, and maybe one of the librarians will be there doing crafts as well.
Fantastic. And you must be somehow resupplying yourself, because I know you had a big turnout for one of the last times you did this.
Yeah. So, yes, I have been resupplying.
Wonderful. We'll have you back on Wandering Nature News in a couple of weeks. And in the meantime, I'll try to find out what the area sugarbush operators are seeing in terms of sap running in the maples, because it's getting to be that time of the year. And a warm day followed by a cold night almost makes me get up ready to go collect sap, and then I realize I haven't done that for 20 years.
Yeah, and depending on how much snow we get this weekend, this upcoming weekend, I know you don't want to talk about more snow as you're just...
Yes, it was a journey.
Talking about shoveling, but we might then be, Duluth might be in the top five snowiest winters since 1870.
Yes.
that was a big sigh.
It is not. I was going to ask a practical question, mm-hmm. if you could check with your wildlife side of the DNR folks about what this means for the winter. What do they call the winter index of severity for?
Yeah,
for
winter severity year? Index. Yeah. Yep.
I know it has not been a particularly cold winter, so that's probably been a factor.
No, but the snowpack, the amount of snow is a huge factor in that WSI. So
especially
it's
if it doesn't stop in March and April, right?
Absolutely. That prolonged, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, thanks. We covered a lot of ground, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks. And think spring, think snow. Do what you have to do. I don't care.
But wander back in 2 weeks.
But for sure you wander back in a couple of weeks as we visit with Michaela Rice from the Minnesota DNR from Gooseberry Falls State Park. Thank you again, Michaela. We'll see you.
Bye.
Bye. This is Leo Babeu for KTWH, Two Harbors Community Radio.